Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. The front page, I'm looking at the front page of today's Financial Times, the big headline, gloomy warning from the Fed. Down the side, UK inflation hits 3.8%. Called to revalue the rial, the Saudi Arabian currency, by 30%. GM is suspending their dividend payments. The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, they're going to try and stop for a 30-day period short selling of bank stocks. In other words, betting against them, buying put options on them. The Fed charts tricky course as clouds gather. Another headline, Treasury chief defends blank check. This is the bailout of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. I mean, they're basically saying any amount of money is fine. Over at JS Mine, M-I-N-E, set.com, which is one of my favorite kind of cranky websites about economics, Jim Sinclair, who runs that thing, he says... The headline for today, his post today, or actually it was yesterday, Tuesday, it has hit the fan. And he said, the financial system is broken, and all that can be done by the U.S. Federal Reserve and U.S. Treasury is to monetize all major financial entities. Monetize a fancy way of saying just throw money at them, print money for them. He says, the reason this has happened is the $1.114 quadrillion, that would be $1,000 trillion mountain of crap paper made of unfunded, unlisted, unregulated, and non-transparent financial specific performance contracts called OTC derivatives. And he said, I cannot imagine you reading the information above and failing to protect yourself, but knowing mankind, I doubt many did. One, you should hold no dollars except what is required to pay bills for 6 months. We're talking real alarmist stuff here. He says, you know now that the FDIC is grossly underfinanced. Get all your money out of financial entities now before you have to stand in line to get it. Screw interest rates. Keep 6 months of cash in your safety deposit box. Invest the balance in short-term securities of other currencies. Number two, put a minimum of one-third of your liquid net worth in gold and gold equivalents. That would be things like coins. Number three, you surely know by now that the SIPC is grossly underfinanced when it comes to covering potential claims. Now, I didn't know that much about it, so I looked up the SIPC. In fact, I've got this. This is the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, and I've got their annual report. You can SIPC.org is their website. And in their annual report, they've got, now here we have hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of dollars that investors have out there, and the SIPC is supposed to backstop us. Their total assets, $1.5 billion, about a day and a half's worth of spending in Iraq. So all this stuff coming all at once, and I'm looking at this stuff going, man, this is exactly what Ravi Batra was talking about the last time we spoke with him. And or maybe not. I mean, maybe I'm misinterpreting it, but I wanted to get him back on. Dr. Ravi Batra is with us, the professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, international, New York Times, best-selling author of numerous books, including The New Golden Age, his most recent, and Greenspan's Fraud, the one that came out before that, and certainly one of my favorites. I think everybody should read these two books. Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com is his website. Dr. Batra, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
You heard the headlines. You heard me read from Jim Sinclair's website, jsmindset.com. has Jim Sinclair gone off the edge? Is the Financial Times, I mean, they're not saying take your money out of the banks now, run for cover, but it looks like the Saudis are getting ready to do that.
Well, things are getting worse by the day. I remember last time I was on your show, I think it was June 27th. I looked it up the other day. And my last, declaration on your show was, watch out for July. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, you also said that you were using the word, was it crisis or disaster, and that an economist does not use these words lightly.
Right. I said it was a disaster in the making, and watch out for July when it would all begin.
Yeah.
And I think from the very first week of July, it has started, and they're having hearings every day. Even right now, Ben Bernanke is answering questions in the Senate. So things are quite bad. They are not as bad as Mr. Sinclair says. They're not as bad right now, but they could get as bad as he implies or what he says.
Yeah. Well, I think what he's suggesting is he's saying do this for the next 6 months. And I've been, you know, and I'm not an advocate of people pulling their money out of banks, and I don't want to, you know, panic people on the show. I mean, there's certainly a lot of very alarmist folks out there. And then there's, you know, a lot of rational voice. I mean, Paul Krugman a couple of days ago in the New York Times was saying, well, it's not so bad, you know.
No, I think things are, well, there's something called ignorance is bliss. Have you heard of that?
Yeah. it's a great question.
When you are ignorant of the cause and effect, then you say, oh, don't worry, things are not so bad. In fact, the last time, one reason I picked July as the start of the fiasco was that I heard Paul Paulson, Ben Bernanke, George Bush, everybody coming out and saying things are fine, things are fine. I thought they're really in bad shape. That means if they're coming out so openly and trying to assure the public. So the basic, there is a fundamental problem with the economy, and they are trying to fix that fundamental problem by creating more money, and that cannot be done anymore. The system's ability to solve its problems by creating more debt is now gone, because you cannot create more debt anymore.
Well, we have Paulson saying that there should be absolutely no limit on the, you know, there's a statutory limit right now of the amount of money that can be loaned to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae of, I think, $2.3 billion, as I recall. The Financial Times is talking about it. And he wants to just blow that limit out completely. No limit whatsoever. He wants a total blank check. And if the Treasury has a blank check, that's known as running the printing presses, basically creating money out of nothing. And, I mean, that's what the Germans did in order to repay. You know, the Weimar Republic had to repay the debt from the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, and it was a crushing debt. And so they just said, okay, screw it. You know, we owe them a trillion Deutschmarks. We'll make it so that a trillion Deutschmarks, which used to represent, you know, the entire wealth of the nation for a year, now represents the cost of a loaf of bread. They debased their currency in order to pay off their debt. Have we run up so much debt? Have we, you know, such a crisis here that we're, I mean, it seems to me like we're debasing our currency.
Well, we don't have that same problem, because Weimar Republic had to pay money out in foreign currency. So they needed to generate foreign currency and then pay off that debt. We don't have foreign currency debt. Our currency is foreign currency.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is other countries have to worry about it, the debasement of our currency. We don't have to worry about. We have to worry about inflation at home.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other countries which hold so many dollars, they have to worry about the dollar declining sharply. And so we don't have that kind of problem. But what our problem is that the banking system is beginning to falter faster than it was last year. And now the banking system could be on the verge of collapse soon. By soon, I mean within a year, 6 to 12 months.
Yeah.
That is our biggest problem. We don't have the problem that we have to meet foreign obligations. The problem is domestic obligations. And like this Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, they have been much in news right now, and they're, as you said, they're talking about giving them a blank check. That would be very inflationary at home.
Yeah. In other words, debasing the currency. That's just, it's dropping the value of the dollar through the floor in order to be able to, well, in order to be able to pay off, you know, to, it's printing, it's increasing the money supply when you're not increasing the number of goods and services in the economy.
Well, see, even that would not be very harmful in today's global economy, because we can always get cheap goods from China. And I think these foreign countries will find, they will come, they won't supply us goods because the dollar would be worthless.
Yeah, and this is why the Saudis are looking at the real. Can you stick around for the hour and maybe take some calls?
Oh, sure. In fact, I've been getting emails saying, people saying you don't stick around long enough.
Okay, great. We'll have you on for the hour, and 866-303-2270 if you have questions. Dr. Robbie Batra with us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, indeed, it's time to throw the rascals out. 21 minutes past the hour. Robbie Batra, Dr. Robbie Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University and author of Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age, RobbieBatra.com. His website is with us. Neither Dr. Batra nor I are investment advisors. We're taking your calls, but not, please don't call with, you know, should I buy this kind of stock, or, you know, what should I do about my investments, or this or that kind of thing. Really, this is a discussion of the larger issues, the bigger picture issues. How did we get here? What is this, you know, what are the consequences of this? What does this agency do? That kind of thing, if we can kind of stick to that. Robbie, before we take the calls, any points you wanted to make about where we're at and how we got here?
Well, you know, a lot of people are worried about their bank savings, other than just stocks. So they're worried about some other things like real estate, et cetera. Those kind of things we can discuss, how you should treat the bank, your bank savings, real estate, whether you should sell the house or not, a variety of things like that in general we can discuss. Mm-hmm. But, like, should I buy IBM or like that?
Right.
That I can't discuss. You know?
Yeah. It makes perfect sense. Okay, so... by the way, what is your, before we get into it, what is your sense of where we're going to be? You know, let me rephrase this. It seems to me that anything that is real, anything that is tangible, you know, gold, oil, wheat, you know, basic commodities, physical things, real estate, over the long term is going to hold value, even if it may lose price. And as the dollar becomes worth less and less, as the Bushies try to inflate their way out of these things, and they, you know, bail out all these agencies and all this other stuff and all this deficit spending and all this borrowing, that those things would be good investments. Those things would be safe places to have your money. Whereas, the stock market, which is, you know, betting on the economic health of the country by and large, seems to me like a scary place to be right now.
Oh, certainly, you're right. But I would caution also about real estate, because it's already overpriced, and it's a high price dependent on all that credit that was available.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not available anymore, so real estate could be down.
Yeah, I wouldn't buy it as an investment, but if I owned my home, I would.
Thing. Yeah, you're right.
But I think
that we are not going to be as badly off as some people are saying, but it could be at least as bad as it was in the early 80s,
mm-hmm.
and could be worse. But not. I don't think we are going to have hyperinflation because we don't have that kind of foreign debt.
And no, I understand that. The question is, are we looking at a 1929 scenario? We can get into that and more. We've got a whole bunch of calls here for you. Let's get to them. Arnold in North Carolina. Hey, Arnold, you're on with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hey, Tom, how you doing, man?
Just great.
This
What's up?
Great show, man. Every time you have Dr. Ravi on it, man, I tell you what, I learned so much. Yeah. Yesterday was a unique day in the world of Mr. George W. Bush. Bernanke was in first class telling the Congress that, you know, the plane is, wings are coming off and, we're looking really bad, but I'm sorry, all the golden parachutes are already handed out to some of Bush cronies now, and Bush is in coach back there telling the world, the rest of the world, at some phony press conference that he hardly ever has, during which time that Bernanke is giving the real bad news of. He's in coach trying to just, you know.
In other words, these are two completely different messages.
Right, the plane is very stable. We're not falling. We're not going to crash. Everything
well, that, that's exactly why I'm so fearful that July will be the start off with the problems.
Yeah, well, you know, Bob Borisaj, is blogging over at Huffington Post today about Wall Street socialism, and he says if these guarantees work, private speculators, having driven the stock down and made a fortune, will clean up on the upside. In other words, they'll buy it cheap and they'll make money as it goes back up again, and the bank's CEOs will continue to pocket the multimillion-dollar salaries. They call it Wall Street socialism. Their losses are socialized. We all cover their losses, and their profits are pocketed, right?
Yeah, that's a great title, Wall Street socialism. Yeah.
It is. Maybe your next book.
Let me suggest one thing. Let's limit the comments and have a question from the audience.
Okay, yeah. Robert in Ludlow, California. Actually, we have about 30 seconds before we've got to take a break. Is it a quick one, Robert?
Yeah, Dr. Batra, I wanted to know your opinion on a 401k. What should we do there? Lay back on my contribution a little bit, and I'll take your answer off the air, sir. Thank you.
Okay.
I would suggest if the 401k is with a bank, that's a better scenario. It's insured by the FDIC, I think, 401k also.
To $250,000.
Right. I want to make sure there's FDIC insuring it, not some other agency. But I think it's insured by FDIC. But you should check on that.
Yeah.
And then it's okay. But banks, FDIC is better than other companies because banks, you can buy CDs from the banks.
So do you think that we could see the failure of some of these places where you can buy and sell stocks, some of these brokerage houses? And if so, what happens to your stock?
Your stock and your 401k. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. Okay. We have Dr. Ravi Batra.
At the very least, it could be tied up.
Yeah, I would. That was my guess. In fact, this is what Jim Sinclair is saying. He says, talk to your broker and get the actual physical certificate. So if the broker goes away, you still got your stock. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Question. 34 minutes past the hour. Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, New York Times best-selling award-winning author of numerous books, including Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age, with us. RaviBatra.com is his website. And Ravi, welcome back. Let's pick up some phone calls here, okay?
Before we do that, let me make a point.
Please.
During the break, I looked up on the internet and looked at the FDIC insurance of retirement accounts.
Mm.
You're right. The limit is $250,000, but it applies only to bank-held, bank and savings associations held retirement accounts. It does not apply to all 401k plans.
Right. So if your 401k is invested in stocks, for example, and those stocks are held by a stock brokerage firm, and that brokerage firm goes out of business, you may have a little bit of a challenge recovering those stocks. Whereas you can ask your broker to actually have the stock certificates physically issued to you, and you take physical possession of them, and you know you can hang it on the wall and look at it. It's a little harder if you're going to sell it. You've got to physically take it back to the broker and say, "Here, I'm giving you back this certificate." But the other advantage of physically taking possession of the stock is that your address then goes to that company, and you get their annual reports and you get all that kind of stuff. Although typically you do anyway.
Also, the stocks can fall very sharply, and I think the stock market is going to go way down before it recovers.
Yeah, but if you had, for example, oil stocks or gold stocks or something like that, which may actually go up. Well,
yeah,
I don't know.
Gold stocks may be okay, yes.
Yeah.
Oil, I'm not sure. Not oil is not doing that well right now. I mean, even the refinery stocks are not doing well. Even ExxonMobil is not doing well, even though oil is rising sharply because there is not much. See, that's the interesting point. There is not much demand for gasoline, and still oil is rising. So it's all speculation.
Yeah, well, and also their costs are going up.
Exactly. I mean, the refineries are actually losing money. Many of them are losing money, and by the way, in all my forecasts, I made forecasts from 2007 to 2015. All of them are in this new book, The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. That's the part I want to emphasize now. Now the golden age comes after the economic chaos, and so we have this window of about 4 to 5 years coming up where we could have total economic chaos, and we need to prepare for that right now. And I have some preparing suggestions in this new golden age.
Great. Okay. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jack in Shelburne, Massachusetts. You're on with Ravi Batra.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a Fannie Mae shareholder and have been since the early 90s. So I get their annual reports. I keep an eye sort of on them. I'm not a scholar on Fannie Mae, but I have to wonder that I looked on the web, have there been a lot of defaults in Fannie Mae mortgages? And the numbers I can find are like 1.1%, 1.4%. So Fannie Mae is holding a lot of mortgages, and these aren't junk mortgages. They're the conforming mortgages that banks have to have certain standards for income and everything else before they can sell them to Fannie Mae. So I think that there's some kind of fix in here. The right wing has never liked Fannie Mae because it's a descendant of a Roosevelt program, and the left wing hasn't been crazy about it because it has private shareholders. But is there any indication of normal, everyday, 30-year fixed mortgages being in high rates of default?
Well, the problem is there are a lot of foreclosures occurring, and there is no end in sight to the problem. Home prices are falling, and those falling assets are held by essentially Fannie Mae. Now, Fannie Mae's default rate may be only 1%, but Fannie and Freddie together hold $5 trillion of mortgages. So just make 1% of $5 trillion is $50 billion, and that's the loss they're facing. And that's exactly why they need some kind of bailout, and that's why the stock price is so down.
$50 billion exceeds their liquidity.
No, it doesn't exceed their liquidity, but just to imagine 1 year's loss of $50 billion.
But people are still on the hook to pay their mortgages.
Well, no, foreclosures mean people can't pay mortgages.
Well, but most of the people aren't in foreclosure. Plus, Fannie is in the business of when a house is foreclosed, on the behalf of the bank, they go in there and, you know, clean it up and whatever and market it, try to get what's out of it.
A lot of these homes were overpriced. They were overvalued.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the stock market can sense it. And even if you are right, certainly the stock market is not buying the federal assurances on that.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. I've got to move along here. Rex in Mount Vernon, Washington. Hey, Rex, you're on the air.
Hi. I agree with Dr. Batra that the stock market's going to drop, continue to drop, and precipitously, in my opinion. And I'm just wondering, I haven't seen much on bonds. being a high school teacher, I have limited ability to move anything around, and so I'm wondering if bonds are going to take a hit too, if that's in his vision.
Well, there are two types of bonds. Some of them are really reliable AAA bonds. Those will be safe, and then there are others issued by corporations that companies are not that safe. So bonds which are issued
You know, the corporate debt, the corporate bonds of Enron were once rated AAA, weren't they?
Well, even the rating agencies, yeah, you're right. The rating itself is not reliable anymore, but companies like IBM, Microsoft, etc., will have their highly valued debt. But even there is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Interest rates have fallen sharply recently, so bond prices have actually gone up, and some people have made a lot of money selling those bonds back.
Mm-hmm.
But I think inflation is going to rise soon. You can see it on the horizon. That means interest rates will rise, and then all sorts of bonds will suffer, even the good bonds.
Even federally issued bonds.
Right. The bond prices will fall as inflation heats up.
Yeah, okay. Dan in Boston, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Ravi Batra.
Hey, Tom. Nice to talk to you again. We know that energy independence is absolutely, it's probably taking top billing right now. What are the odds that we can demand that we put wind farms off the coast of Cape Cod, we put wind farms up in the upper northwest, midwest, and put solar panel fields down in the southwest to at least make a legitimate first step towards energy independence? Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Tim.
Well, many things are needed for energy independence, and what you suggested is correct. But I think we could get energy independence within a year if we simply were to do just two things. First of all, raise sharply the margin requirements of all hedge funds. They should be asked to put up 50% of anything they buy. That would be one thing. The other thing would be to break up the oil companies. These are the two forces responsible for the big jump in the price of oil. Now, some people suggest that if we were to take all these steps, oil trading would move away to, say, the Middle East. Well, the Middle East doesn't have these facilities to trade oil. It will take at least a year for them to start up the facilities. And in 1 year, the oil price will crash. And then no more speculation after that. So I think, yeah, we need to have energy independence, but a lot of things have to be done at the same time.
Hmm. Interesting. Daniela in San Luis Obispo.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I had a question about would it be a good idea to get buy euros, and how one does buy euros?
You can buy what's called Euro ETFs, FXE.
Mm-hmm.
Is the Euro ETF, and that's
these are exchange traded funds. It's you're basically buying a fund that invests in that buys euros.
Euros, right.
What they hold is a foreign currency.
Right, they hold euros, and they're at all time high right now. So the best way to buy is to buy the that FXE and then sell some covered option on it so that you're getting some income also from it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see here. Sean in Santa Rosa. Hey, Sean.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on the show, guys. I am a mortgage and real estate broker out here, and there's, you know, I have a lot of clients that are, you know, either in the process of buying a house or wanting to invest. And I heard you say something that kind of contrary to what I always believe, but you said real estate may not be the best place to invest at this point. And then, you know, I'm not always sure the mechanics of how what's going on is going to impact the rates. So maybe you could say something about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, real estate has gone up quite a lot. And even though prices have fallen in some parts of the country, especially California and Florida, it's not going to make a comeback for a long time, as long as the headlines are, well, prices are falling.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why real estate is not a good investment at this time. But the interest rates depend on the rate of inflation, and if inflation goes up, interest rates will rise.
Yeah, which will make the price of real estate further fall.
Further fall, right.
45 minutes past the hour. Dr. Avi Batra with us, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com as well. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Tom Hartman program, by the way, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Find out more at Teamster.org. Dr. Avi Batra on the line with us, RaviBatra.com, his website, the author of The New Golden Age, as well as many other books. Susan in Vancouver, Washington, you're on the air with Dr. Avi Batra and me. Susan?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, my gosh. I'm wondering if a Vanguard money market fund that is not insured, a retirement fund, is a safe place to keep money. I could transfer it to a money market fund that's backed by the federal government, insured by the federal government, but I'm not sure that's safe either.
Yeah. Well, Susan, we can't advise you specifically, but broadly speaking, Dr. Batra.
Broadly speaking, the point is that many of these mutual funds are, I think, at this point, safe. We don't know about the future. And safer than these are money market funds offered by the banks. So if there is not that much difference in interest in the yields, then I would prefer to have them with banks.
Have it in a bank with the FDIC insurance.
Exactly.
Ed in Tucson, Arizona, you're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I'm retired and have tax-free munis, Arizona munis, and I live off the interest. And just wondering how safe you feel Arizona munis are in the state.
These are tax-free municipal bonds. They're issued by cities within the state. Municipal debt?
At this point, they should be okay. But in the future, they should be okay as long as they're AAAs.
Right. So, in other words, if we're looking at a 1970s, 1980s stagflation scenario, then municipal bonds, treasuries, things like that, no problem. If we're looking at a 1929, or really a 1932, 1933, bank holiday scenario, then I mean there were cities that were declaring bankruptcy.
Yeah, that's so it's very hard to say then. You know, I don't want to cause a panic, and so you just have to disperse your assets into various areas rather than putting them into just one little or two few things.
Yeah. Dave in Los Angeles on K-Talk. You're on the air with Dr. Batra.
Hi, Tom. Dr. Batra, I'd like to get your opinion on the recent change that Congress just made, this week, about enforcing the law against naked short selling, but only against Freddie and Fannie Mae and the prime brokers. This has been illegal for 70 years, and the community has been screaming about this for 8 years. They've turned a blind eye to it. They put many companies out of business, put a lot of people out of work. And
You're talking about is the short sellers?
The naked, uncovered, fail-to-delivers, naked shorting.
Okay. Why don't you explain what that is, Dave, for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about?
Oh, very simply, what they're doing, there's a hedge fund's particular, David Rocker's one of the most famous, goes out and they short stock, they sell stock that does not exist. It's counterfeiting. They go out there, they never get the borrows. They never borrow the stock from somebody else to sell it. That's called a naked short.
How do you do that?
Because the DTCC, which is the clearinghouse, has not been enforcing this. They've just been turning blind.
This is not a classic put or call. This is
illegal.
Yeah,
that doesn't exist, really.
Yeah, it doesn't exist. So you're saying, Dave, that these new regulations, or the what are being billed as new regulations that are, that Paulson and whatnot are calling for, are actually just enforcing the old law? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely correct, but only against.
But only for financial institutions, the biggest financial institutions. So these guys are free to screw every other company in America.
Correct. And if you look into this, they put so many companies out of business. BioVail. Patrick Byrne from Overstock has been championing this issue for at least 5 years. He's got excellent resources showing you the mechanics, exactly how it's done. There was hearings Orrin Hatch called in Congress on it. In the last minute, the actual agenda of the hearing was changed. The 109th Congress would not let him pursue the issue.
Yeah. Well, these guys are probably carpet bombing Congress with money right now. Robbie Botcher, thoughts on this? Thank you, Dave.
Well, they're still not waking up, I guess. You know, more hits. They'll take more hits before they outlaw all sorts of short selling.
Yeah. Okay. Tom in San Diego, you're on with Dr. Botcher.
Oh, hi, Tom. Dr. Batra, I spent about a third of the year down in Mexico, about an hour south of San Diego, and I'm wondering how the economic changes in America are going to change the situation in Mexico. I think they got hit harder than we did in the 80s.
Oh, they'll be hit very hard. That depends so much on the United States, also on the repatriation of earnings by Mexican nationals over here. So they'll be hit very hard.
So not a now for an American who is basically just vacationing in Mexico, if Mexico gets hit very hard, I mean, it's a terrible thing, but that is not a bad thing for economically. You know, I mean, it may mean that things are cheaper in Mexico for Americans.
Well, but you may have to worry more about crime there then.
Oh, yeah. So you've got all the social problems that go along with the economic disaster. That makes perfect sense. See, the moral dimension always does have an economic dimension and a reality dimension as well. Ellie in Lolita, California, we just have a minute here before we get to wrap up this hour.
Yes, just a quick question. Onto CDs, are they safe?
Bank certificates of deposit?
Yeah, CDs are fairly safe. They're safe.
They are safe.
Yeah.
And they're protected by the FDIC up to
$100,000. There is an insurance limit, right?
Yeah, up to the limit of $100,000 or $250,000 if it's in your 401k. So, final thoughts, Dr. Batra?
My final thoughts are that I hope they pay attention to all the reforms I've suggested. There are ways to stop it, but new debt creation is not the way to do that. Many things can be done, but they're not doing that. And all I suggest to the public is wake up. Read my book and tell others about it. You have to prepare yourself.
Yeah, the book is the new golden age, and you're suggesting radical things like raising the minimum wage. and hey, how about taxes? And let's pay for what we're, in any case.
Cutting back on free trade.
Yeah, cut back on free trade. Exactly. Dr. Robbie Botcher, robbiebotcher.com, the website. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. 57 minutes past here.
This is Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So these two companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, spent $200 million lobbying Congress. John McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, on their payroll. Jim Johnson, who was, until he got outed for all this kind of stuff, the VP vetter for Obama. At least 20 of McCain's fundraisers lobbying for them, receiving over $12 million in fees. Tip of the hat to the chat room. One of the folks there let us in on this story. This is actually ABC News publishing it. Brian Ross and Rhonda Schwartz. Hundreds of super-rich American tax cheats have, in effect, turned themselves into the IRS. After a bank computer technician in the tiny European country of Liechtenstein came forward with the names of U.S. citizens who had set up secret accounts there, according to Washington lawyers investigating the scheme. This guy, Heinrich Kieber, 5 years ago said, "That's it. I'm over it with this. They call him a disgruntled technician, whether he was over it with the bank or whether he was over it with his employer or well, I don't know what he was over it with, but he was over it. And so what he did was he filled three CDs full of all the names and financial data on millionaires and billionaires who were stashing their money in Liechtenstein's banks to avoid paying taxes, including many Americans. In Germany, as a result of this, in Italy, actually, they published the names in the newspapers. In Germany, because of this, a number of prominent CEOs were arrested on charges that they had evaded millions of dollars in taxes. A former UBS private banker, Bradley Birkenfeld, has agreed to a plea deal and is cooperating with U.S. authorities to bring charges against American citizens. And interestingly enough, Washington lawyers say a number of prominent U.S. citizens have been subpoenaed to testify before Carl Levin's committee, the banking committee, but have already indicated that they will refuse to testify, asserting their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. It's not yet clear whether Senator Levin will insist that they appear in front of the committee anyway. So this is, as Bob Borisov is saying, you know, we have Wall Street socialism. We're backstopping the CEOs, the millionaires and the billionaires, who, by the way, on the side are, you know, cleaning up, and the average person is getting screwed. And I would submit to you that a large part of this comes from this bizarre philosophy that came along with Ronald Reagan when he came into office, that greed is good, and that, it, in fact, not only is it good, but it's the only thing that motivates people. It's the only thing that motivates people. And therefore, even civil servants, even people who join the Peace Corps, even people who run for public office, even they're all doing it simply because there's something in it for them. And, of course, if you believe that, if that's your core philosophy, then you surround yourself with people who are doing it only because there is something in it for them, because you figure that they're at least honest. I mean, this is the assumption that the conservatives have been operating under, and this is why you have all these corrupt officials. This is why the Reagan administration had more senior officials go to jail for corruption than any administration in the history of the United States. Because Reagan didn't believe in the idea of public service. He didn't believe the government could solve any problems. He didn't believe that anybody would do anything for other people simply because they cared about their fellow man. He didn't believe in citizenship. He didn't believe that the Reagan, and to this day, the Reagan conservatives don't believe this, the Limbaughs of the world, the Hannitys of the world. They don't believe in the idea of a collective society, of a culture that we're all in this together. They don't believe in what the founders viewed as patriotism. They instead think that if everybody is simply fulfilling their own selfish self-interest, that this magic market will suddenly just click into being and everything will be fine. And in fact, you know, markets do work for buying and selling of goods. And they will stimulate an economy at a certain level, but to what end? Are we here to serve the economy, or is the economy here to serve us? And frankly, you know, liberals like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and even in that day, conservatives like Alexander Hamilton believed that the economy was here to serve us, not the other way around. That we encourage and facilitate business in order to produce a public good. And we're looking now at numbers, you know, GDP, we're looking at gross domestic product and things like that. And as, you know, Robert Kennedy famously said, GDP is not the indicator. It's not the thing that tells you whether the country is really doing well. All it does is it tells you if there's a lot of money flying around. I mean, that's it. In fact, this is Bobby Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, when he was running for president, talking about this very issue.
Too much and for too long, we seem to have surrendered personal excellence and community values in the mere accumulation of material things. Our gross national product now is over $800 billion a year. But that gross national product, if we judge the United States of America by that, ECMO's national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertisements and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwoods and the loss of our natural wonders and chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm, and it counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police to fight the riots in our cities. It counts Whitman's rifle and Speck's knife and the television programs which glorify violence in order to sell toys to our children. Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
Now, there's a guy who had enough money that he didn't need to be in it for the money. I mean, Bobby Kennedy didn't go into public service for him. He did it for us. And it's so anyway, we are looking at an economy right now that is being wildly distorted by these huge increases in the price of oil. And I know there are some folks out there who are saying, oh, it's all speculators. And yeah, speculation is driving it somewhat. And there are other folks who are saying, oh, it's peak oil. And then other folks say, well, wait a minute. If it was peak oil, then that would mean that there would be gas lines at the, you know, lines at the pump. There would be shortages. And there's no shortages, so it can't be peak oil. It can't be consumption driving this thing. Well, the fact of the matter is there are shortages. There are shortages. It's just that we're, you know, the old, the rich folks don't worry about the shortages kind of thing. Well, in the world, we're the rich folks. Nepal, for example, millions of farmers have been hit by an acute fuel shortage, say local petroleum dealers. Nepal Oil Corporation has not been able to supply even 50% of the required diesel and petrol. The situation could get worse if the government does not find a solution. Most gas stations have been gradually shutting down. Farmers depending on diesel to be able to use water pumps and tractors. The harvesting and planting season has already started, and there's concern that fuel shortages could not only affect harvests, but also lead to price increases for fertilizer and food. Over 75% of Nepal's 28 million people depend on agriculture for their livelihood. This is whacking them. Pakistan. Twilight in Karachi. This is from the BBC. And outside some of the main restaurants in Pakistan's economic and financial capital, you will find the city's poor waiting. They line up most days of the week to get a chance to grab some of the free food that is doled out here. Hands outstretched, they're clamoring for what extra help to whatever is on offer. Rising food prices. Zambia's sole petroleum refinery runs out of crude oil feedstock. In other words, crude oil. Zambia's petroleum refinery, INDENI petroleum refinery, has stopped producing petroleum products after running out of crude oil. In January, Zambia awarded a $1.2 billion two-year oil supply contract to Kuwait's International Petroleum Group. Cape Town, South Africa. South Africa faces the possibility of fuel shortages when it hosts the 2010 World Soccer World Cup, a senior government official said on Wednesday. In the third quarter of 2009, we're expecting that South Africa won't be able to supply our fuel needs unless something drastic is done. And, you know, it goes on impact of fuel shortages on the Gaza situation. China shuts down more coal power plants, warns on shortage. China, the world's second largest energy consumer, shut down 22.5% of its coal-fired plants, prompting local governments to limit electricity consumption and issue warnings on possible blackouts.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Yeah. that our statesmen and stateswomen. Now, I'm reluctant to use the word politician here because it's been so contaminated by Reaganism. But our statesmen and stateswomen, I think that they need to be speaking once again about the concept of public service. And we need to be celebrating this. I mean, it's the idea that you know, Bush, he's the guy I want to have a beer with. Yeah, that's why I'm going to vote for him. And you've got all these guys on the right who are trashing Obama, saying, oh, he's an elitist, you know. He speaks in complete sentences. He was at the head of his class in Harvard Law School. Now, when it was a white guy, when it was Jack Kennedy, we celebrated that. White people in America celebrated that. They said, it's Camelot. It's the new American aristocracy. Isn't it a marvelous thing? When it was Jack Kennedy, the white people in America were saying, oh, yeah, he's an elitist. Isn't that wonderful? When it's Barack Obama, they say, oh, he's arrogant. Which I'm telling you is code to an awful lot of white racists out there for uppity. So here we have this economic disaster, a whole variety of them, most of them grounded in 30 years of Reaganomics, now compounded. And keep in mind, peak oil hit the United States in 74. It's hitting the world right now, compounded by peak oil worldwide, which is driving up the price of oil and is making some people downright crazy. Our full Monty alert for the day. Yeah, real slow.
Real slow.
Yeah, Bobby Davis owns a brothel in Nevada.
David, take off your shoes.
It's called the Shady Lady Ranch.
I'll take your shoes.
And she's decided that if you spend 4 hours with one of the brothel's shady ladies at $300 an hour, then you get $200 worth of free gas. Yeah. You can leave your hat on. Or if you're Elliot Spitzer, leave your socks on, I guess. But anyway, it's... So here we have a global food crisis that's going on. In the past year, the price of food has risen sharply. Wheat has gone up by 130%, rice by 217%, corn by 125%, soybeans by 107%. Why might that be? Well, it could be that we have too many people. I mean, sometimes Occam's razor is right. Sometimes the simplest solution actually is the answer to the question. It took the entirety of human history to reach the first 1 billion people in the world in 1800. When the Revolutionary War was fought, when the Constitution was put together, there weren't even a billion people on the planet. There were only about 15 million Europeans in North America. And Europeans had been in North America for a couple of hundred years. So here we have a billion people in 1800. The second billion didn't take the 165,000 years that the first billion took to produce. The second billion only took 130 years, 1930, when Franklin Roosevelt, in 32, when Franklin Roosevelt ran for president, there were 2 billion people on Earth. We had just hit 2 billion people. The third billion only took 30 years, 1960. Jack Kennedy was inaugurated. There were only 3 billion people on the planet, 3 billion mouths to feed, 3 billion people needing oil or gasoline or electricity. The fourth billion took only 14 years, 1974. The fifth billion took only 13 years, 1987. The sixth billion took only 12 years, 1999. And we're now moving in toward the seventh billion. We have, you know, the fundamental issue here. I mean, there's a whole bunch. I realize that I'm skipping around, but I'm trying to pull it all together into one piece. And that is that we have this explosion of population, which is driven by a dysfunctional culture in large part. You find those countries and those societies, those cultures, where women are the property of men, is where you see the greatest population explosions. In those countries and those societies where women have relatively equal power with men, you have zero population growth. So number one, and you look at the religions, you look at the cultures, you'll see that as a major driver. So number one, we have this huge explosion in population. Number two, we've seen a flattening over the last 10 years in the amount of oil that's being discovered and that is being drilled out. And the discovery part is the important part, because that leads at, you know, what's being pulled out by about a decade. And when you see a flattening of the discoveries, and that's what's happened over the last decade, then, yeah, you really are approaching the peak. And now we're seeing it show up in the prices of oil. And this is driving other commodities and the price of food as well. I mean, it's the bottom line. There's too many people, and our political systems, in the face of this very real crisis, our political systems in the United States for 30 years have been driven by the idea that every decision should be made by who is the most predatory, who is the most greedy, and the whole idea of this free market, Thomas Friedmanism, it's nuts.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Past the hour, $2,040,817,562,029, the amount of money spent by foreign entities to buy out American companies since 1978. $2 trillion. These insane economic policies of this administration and going back to Reagan started, and frankly, a little bit of that insanity started under Jimmy Carter with the whole deregulation craze as neoliberalism was rising. But by and large, it was Ronald Reagan who started this process of selling off, of bankrupting America, of running up massive debts, spending that money to make it look like things were good. Spend us into prosperity. And do it on the back of debt and particularly then as our balance of trade became worse and worse and worse, all these foreign companies and countries owning our debt and we owed them money for stuff we bought from them. And so they come over here and say, okay, that's fine. You owe us $2,040,817,840. We'll take it in, we'll take a piece of Citicorp, and we'll take the Rockefeller building, and we'll take the Chrysler building, and we'll take the, and on and on and on it goes. I think we'll buy Budweiser today. America for sale. We've become a third world nation. Salomon in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Salomon, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was watching Kucinich on the floor last night. Couldn't Bush resign before his office is out, and then have Cheney pardon him for all these crimes as far as Iraq and so on?
Yeah, he could, but he's sufficiently I think there's two things at work here. One is his own hubris, his own belief in his own, that nothing bad will ever touch him because he's always been protected by daddy and by his rich buddies. And, this is how every one of his business ventures, except for his stock in the baseball team, tanked. And yet he never paid any consequences. In fact, he made money every single time. So I think he's got a belief in his own infallibility on the one hand. And number two, you've got the fact that, and this I think is the reason why there's no impeachment hearings right now. You've got a bunch of Democrats who are complicit. You've got Democrats who, including Nancy Pelosi, who went and saw back when it was happening, went and saw the virtual tours of the U.S. torture chambers around the world and waterboarding and whatnot. And I think that was the administration's way of bringing in these Democrats so that they were as dirty as the administration. And it was during a time of fear and terror. I mean, people were scared to death. and bringing them in and making them dirty so that it down the road they would be safe, and I think that they are. So I don't think the Bush is going to resign. I don't think there's a chance of it. Because I think he thinks that he's invincible and he doesn't think that he's going to be prosecuted. People down the line probably will be prosecuted. You know, the Doug Feiths of the world. In fact, there's already the investigation starting. But, Salomon, I don't think it's going to happen. Thanks for the call, though, and bringing it up. It's an interesting theory. Isaac in Federal Way, Washington, you have a theory about all this?
Yes, Tom.
Yeah.
I'm a big admirer of the show, and I just wanted your honest opinion on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And do you believe it was an inside job? I haven't been listening to you that long, so I haven't heard any of your comments on that. Seems like
yeah.
I was kind of swept it under the rug.
We've done a couple of shows on it. You know, David Ray Griffin has been on the program 3 or 4 times over the last 4 or 5 years, or 6 years we've been doing this show. 6-8 months ago, we did a big debate. We got some of the folks from, you know, 911truth.org and I think it was Reason Magazine on. But the bottom line is, my opinion is that I don't know. I just honestly don't know. There are some theories that seem to me like they're probably a little far out there. But on the other hand, had you told me in 1999 that that five Republican members of the Supreme Court could steal an election, that the brother of the candidate for president could steal an election down in Florida, had you told me just any of even the simple stuff that has gone on, I would have said, oh, come on, that's crackpot stuff. So I'm frankly willing to consider the possibility of just about anything and not certain of any of it. I mean, I've seen how long it took us to figure out who killed Jack Kennedy and how many years and dollars of research went into that, and there's still a debate on that topic. I don't think that we're going to know anytime soon, but I do think that we need to continue looking into it and continue working on finding it out, and I tip my hat. I salute the many, many folks in the United States who are devoting a lot of their time and effort ranging from you know, the occasional hobbyist to people who are literally have given up the rest of their lives, and they're just spending all their time trying to figure out what happened on 9/11. I think it's really important and marvelous, actually. Devron in Seattle. Hey, Devron.
Hello, Tom. I was calling earlier when you had your guest.
Robbie Batron.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned about those of us who don't have stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just basically out here surviving. Because, you know, honestly, I don't think everybody does have stocks or has 6 months' worth of cash laying around. You know,
yeah.
I mean, just honestly, I don't. If I
right.
have to be the only one out here to say it,
no. I think probably the majority of my listeners don't have the mean. I mean, you know,
yeah.
The majority of Americans, I think.
Yeah.
You know.
And one other thing, and I'll let you go because I know I got a lot of callers. This seems real similar. One of your callers said this when Robbie was on to what Mexico went through when they were just printing up lots of money, and you saw the value of the peso go from like 6 pesos to a dollar to 6,000.
Mm-hmm.
So before they, you know, got a hold of it, I think it was like 1,000,000 pesos to a dollar or something. It was just crazy, and I really do feel for Mexico because you know they're dependent on us. But
yeah, it's happened. It's happened there. It's happened in many of the South
yeah.
American countries. It's happened all over the world. Inflation, you know, getting out of control. You know, thanks a lot for the call. And you know what we should do, you know, what people should do who don't. I mean, this, frankly, I don't. Let me start over again. There are people who think that they are safely middle class because they got a couple $100,000 in a 401k or in a savings account, and they've got an income of, you know, $50,000, $100,000, $150,000 a year, $200,000 a year. They think they're part of the elite. I got news for you. The people who and the Republicans are pitching them. Hey, you know, Don, we need tax cuts for you guys. Hey, you're one of us. The Republicans, the elite, are the people with assets, you know, in excess of multi-millions of dollars. And it's a very, very, I mean, we're talking a few tens of thousands of people in the United States, you know, 20, 30, 40,000 people, perhaps. It's a relatively small number of people who have the very large assets that can withstand something like another Great Depression. There was a very small number of people who were very wealthy during the last Great Depression. And so, you know, whether somebody's making $20,000 a year or $200,000 a year, if the wheels really come off, everybody's going to be in this thing together. And that's why we all need to be in it together right now with each other. You know, we need to be working collectively on this stuff. Matt in Los Angeles. Hey, Matt.
Yeah. Hey, Tom. I'm glad you brought up the population problem, because I think the real issue is sustainability. The best thing that could happen was for the oil prices to go up, because with a corrupt auto industry, you see what the auto industry is about, bankrupt, because they won't learn anything from any time they're as bad as the oil industry.
Yep. Not to mention the fact that we've got so much carbon coming out as a consequence of all this oil that it's acidifying
our
oceans.
Well, that's right. It had to happen for the global climate, because we're going to destroy. We are already destroying the ecosystem of the planet.
Yeah, and it's real easy. But here's the problem, Matt. It's real easy for you and me to sit here and say, oh, you know, it's a $140 oil or $200 a barrel oil or $300 a barrel oil is going to be a marvelous thing, because it's going to drive the creation of alternative sources of energy, which will be a good thing for everybody. And I think over the long term, that's true. But, you know, the old famous joke, you know, over the long term, we'll all be dead. Try telling that to a long-haul truck driver who makes their living, and they're having to pay, you know, and no longer has a union job. They're making their living.
Okay, that's a policy issue, and because policy has failed in this country for 30 years and much longer, I'm not saying it's marvelous. Take the adjective marvelous out of there. I'm saying essential, because it's just as you're talking about the coming economic collapse, we're talking about a global collapse, and the real issue is sustainability.
Yep.
Under the current economic model, which I'd really like you to address this issue and perhaps write your next book about it. I've been reading Lester Brown since with the World Watch Institute since the 60s, 70s, and following this, and I was studying all these issues in the 70s as well. And if the whole world, the 6-7 billion, and we're on our way to 10 before it's supposed to level out, but if we're to live at our level of lifestyle, see, the Tom Friedmans and everybody else has a model of that everybody should be able to live.
I know, but if everybody did, it would take four planet Earths to provide
natural
resources.
I heard. You know, either way. The model is wrong.
Right.
And so
the model is dysfunctional and unsustainable.
The deforestation that's happening to
Matt, you're absolutely right. And spot on. And I totally agree. And actually, I am writing a book on that. The first book I wrote on this topic is called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I wrote that book in 1996, Ancient Sunlight being oil, because it's, you know, vegetation captured sunlight 300 million years ago. It's now called oil. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And I'm working on a sequel right now, actually. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be careful of what you say. Careful in every way. Be careful of what you do. Big Brother is watching you. Be circumspect and discreet. Stay light on your mental feet. One slip and you know you're through. Big Brother is watching you. Conform with our directives.
9.5 minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And we will actually be getting back to your calls a little bit later on. But right now, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, is on the line with us. Hey, Ellen.
Well, Mr. Bernanke was up today at Barney Frank's committee, and he is talking about that the economy continues to grow, although he said at a subdued pace. Say the least.
Yeah.
He also said that the economy is having a job market problems, housing sector problems. He said it's made worse by declining housing starts, and he also said the unemployment rate has risen in the United States. Then he said that the long-term predictions of available oil supplies are low. which could mean that higher oil prices will continue to plague Americans at the pump.
Mm-hmm.
And he also said the housing crisis was a problem in terms of foreclosures.
Did he at any point ever address the average American wage earner?
Well, I didn't stay for the whole hearing. I was there for the beginning, so he may have, but I didn't hear it as sort of part of the initial hit.
Yeah, I'd be astounded if he had it.
I think so. Also, the White House this afternoon, Dana Perina just said that she had objections. The White House had objections to the bill, and it's interesting because I'm ambivalent as to what I think their objections are. Because
to what bill, Ellen?
I'm sorry?
To what bill?
To the housing bill that is now related also, of course, to Fannie and Freddie to some degree.
Okay.
Because she said that the housing bill has $4 billion to help the states on already foreclosed properties. But she feels that that helps the banks and does not go directly to the mortgagee. And they may be right about that, but I'm always suspicious when they come out with things like that.
Yeah. Wait a minute. The White House saying something that you know, it's on behalf of the average person.
The other thing they said, and again, they're sounding very consumer friendly today, is that she said that the White House has been asking for a GSE regulator, in other words, people to step in and really regulate Fannie and Freddie more intensely since 2003, and Congress has not passed that. I will tell you this, that today the Politico has a story that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac spent $200 million to buy influence. I know somebody personally who made about $10,000 a month trying to help them write congressional testimony, talk to members of Congress, etc. And that's just one person. And I think that their lobbying effort in terms of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was larger than almost the drug companies.
Wow. Wow. Of course, there was billions to be made. I mean, you know.
Well, there was billions to be made, and that's probably why there was no additional regulation of them.
Right. And when you look at $200 million being spent on lobbying, you have to, you know, you look at it in terms of an investment and a return. It's like, you know, the tobacco companies would invest $1 million and they'd get back, you know, the protection against a $500 million lawsuit. You know, there are all these examples actually. There's actually a number of good websites. Ralph Nader's one of the best, you know, with his citizen.org, where they point out that one of the best investments in America is to invest in Congress. If you put $1 million into Congress, you can protect $1 billion in some cases. You can get 1,000-to-1 leverage on your money. And so if $200 million was spent on lobbying, you wonder how many hundreds of millions or billions or tens of billions were looted, basically, were walked off with.
Well, I can just tell you from the person I know who worked for them, it was a very flush organization and included everything from, you know, golfing adventures and
right.
ways to talk to people. I mean, it was really, and even then I thought, well, where are they getting this kind of money? Well,
right.
obviously on the backs of consumers.
Right. These guys were living high.
Okay. It looks the White House today announced something very interesting, and that is that they are actually going to be sending their third largest guy from the State Department will be going to a meeting in Switzerland in Geneva on Saturday with the Iranians. The White House is saying that this is a one-time-only deal. They are putting together a package of incentives. They expect to hear an answer from Iran as to whether Iran is going to take it, and if not, they are going to outline, in quote-unquote, the consequences.
So this is one of two things. Either this is the Bush administration seeking the false comfort of appeasement, right? Because you know, Bush said you shouldn't even talk to these guys, and so now he's talking to them. This is what he condemned Barack Obama for. Or this is a setup for the U.S. or Israel to attack Iran. Do I have that right?
I think you have that exactly correctly.
Yeah.
As I think I've said to you, I have a very pessimistic view of this whole deal.
Yeah. Well, that's not going to be a man. If the Middle East goes up further in flames, it is certainly not going to help oil prices. For example, it's not going to help the U.S. economy. But it will make a whole lot more money for the defense contractors that have surrounded Dick Cheney.
I'm sure. A couple other interesting things. This is sort of very interesting, which is that the famous World Court has also been very concerned about five Mexicans that are sentenced to death, and they had not had adequate counsel, and they were not notified. The Mexican embassy had not.
These are Mexicans in the United States.
That's right.
Right, on death row in the United States.
And
yeah.
The World Court has now ordered the United States to do all it could to halt the imminent execution of the five Mexicans. Sure. One is supposed to be executed on August 5th.
That's fascinating. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. Coming up in the next hour, Beth Gladstone, Larry Scott, David Sirota. It's going to be a busy hour, plus we'll be taking your calls. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Well, you know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes you don't know what you do know, and sometimes, even as the Fireside Theater says so brilliantly, everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind. Everything you know is wrong.
Is it possible everything you know is wrong about the recession is wrong? Beth Pinksker is with us. She is the editor-in-chief of WalletPop.com. Hey, Beth, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. You've got 10 reasons why the recession should be celebrated.
Well, you know, saving money is a good thing to encourage people to do.
Okay, so let's just very quickly in the 5 minutes or so we've got here, let's just go through these things. What the 10 blessings of a recession, 10 reasons to love a recession, what are they?
One is you get less junk mail because it's too expensive for companies to send out credit card flyers and other things like that.
Alrighty.
Another is that there are less people in line in front of you at the gas station because gas is so expensive that they're visiting less often.
Fewer people can afford it, yeah.
People are eating at home more often, which means that families are eating dinner together rather than just picking up something on the go. And many studies have shown that eating dinner together is one way that families communicate and families stay together.
Yeah, that's actually a serious and genuinely good thing, regardless of recession or not. But, yeah, okay.
Exactly. It's also healthier.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is that there are more coupons and more deals out there right now because businesses are offering incentives for people to buy. Starbucks is offering coupons. There are many other businesses that are offering incentives right now.
Right. Okay.
Another one is that free fitness is good for you, riding a bike. We talk about this as a trifecta idea, something that's good for you, that saves you money, and is good for the environment.
Right.
So biking is one of those things.
Yeah, when I was in Denmark a couple months ago, last month we did our show from Copenhagen. One-third, 33% or 32% of all the wage earners, all the people who work in Copenhagen, ride their bicycle to work.
That's an excellent thing.
Yeah, I didn't see, you know, very many overweight people there. It was very, you know, people seemed to be in pretty good shape.
Also, use of public transportation is way up all across the country, not just in major cities, which also helps the environment.
Yep.
Another one that's kind of cheeky one, but you can get an SUV at a really good price right now.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Recessions are also very good for entrepreneurs. Laid-off employees and businesses that are restricted often come up with innovative ways to start their own businesses and really succeed.
You're right. I've started two businesses in recessions, and both of them were very, very successful.
Yeah, wages are down, rents are cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's not as much competition out there. It's a great time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that's a trifecta one is gardening, especially if you grow your own vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for you. It's good for the environment. It saves you money.
Mm-hmm.
this is another cheeky one, but artists are often inspired by financial downturns in the economy,
mm-hmm.
Singing the blues and all sorts of things.
Yeah, a lot
like
of great
that.
Music came out of the Great Depression.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one that we came up with was new perspectives. Give you time, especially if you're laid off, to think about your life, to think about what you really want to do. A lot of people change course at a time like this,
mm-hmm.
Especially if their company is going through struggles. You know, if they're in a job that they don't like anyway and the company is in trouble, they take a break and they see what they really want to do.
So there may be an upside to all this. 10 reasons to love a recession and, you know, a lot of great financial information, by the way, over at walletpop.com.
Thank you.
Beth, thanks so much for dropping by.
No problem.
Beth Pinsker, the editor-in-chief over at walletpop.com. 10 reasons why you should be happy that we're in a recession. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Deborah in Beaverton, Oregon. Hey, Deborah.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
Real quick before I get to the question that I wanted to, or the topic I wanted to bring up.
Mm.
When I was in my late teens, I read a book called The Late Great Planet Earth that mentioned an organization.
Yeah, by Hal Lindsey.
By Hal Lindsey.
Yeah, I read it too.
And it mentioned something called the Trilateral Commission.
Yep.
So I'm sure you know more about it than I could possibly ever attempt to try and find out, so I will let you explain that. But the other thing that I'm confused about, and this is, it's not because I don't get this, oil's bad. It's bad for our economy, it's bad for the planet, it's bad for everything. If we don't stop using it, we're going to be in big trouble.
Right.
But I have a girlfriend that lives in Texas who, because she has friends who are geologists who go out and find oil things for oil companies, she keeps insisting that we don't have an oil shortage. And it's not, and I told her, I said, I don't think the oil shortage is the issue. I said, we could have enough oil to last for another 400 years. We won't have a planet to live on if we keep burning it up.
Yeah, there's that issue. There's also just, you know, the reality. I mean, the best estimate is that there was about 2 trillion barrels of oil in the ground in the 1860s when Colonel Drake, I think it was 1864, when Colonel Drake drilled his famous oil well in Titusville, Pennsylvania, that, you know, the first gusher started the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
And we've pumped out about half of that. And that 50% point, and that's only half, you know, that 50% point is what M. King Hubbard referred to, has been referred to, I think before his death even, as Hubbard's peak, and or Hubbard's peak, rather. And that's the point at which it starts getting expensive to pull it out of the ground. Doesn't mean it's not there. Doesn't mean that there's a shortage of it. What it means is it's getting more expensive. To pull out of oil out of the ground, you've got to suck on the straw. And that takes energy. It takes energy that is run by oil. I mean, the pumps that pump the oil out are run by oil themselves and or petroleum products. And so you've got very cheap oil in some parts of the world. And historically, I mean, when we had geysers, the oil was literally pumping itself out of the ground. And virgin oil, fresh oil, you know, untapped wells. Much of the oil in Iraq, for example, it's going to cost less than $1.50 a barrel to get that stuff out of the ground. Because the oil wells are so full, they've got their own pressure, that you don't have to suck on that straw. It just comes bubbling out. It's like shaking a Coke and opening the can. You know, it's boom, there it is. So it's really, really cheap oil. On the other hand, when that oil well gets to the point where it's half empty, oil is really thick and heavy stuff, and you're drawing it up from a half a mile down underneath the earth through a pipe. You've got to suck really hard on that straw, and that becomes very expensive. And so much of the oil in the United States, we hit Hubbard's peak in 74 in the United States, and what happened was it started costing us around $12, $13, $14 a barrel to pull that oil out of the ground. And at that point, a lot of oil wells just got capped. So, yeah, there is a lot of oil out there. There's a lot of oil capacity. There's not an absolute shortage of oil. What's happening is that we're reaching this point where the cost of drawing oil out of the ground is starting to be reflected in the actual price of oil.
And okay, and there's one more thing I want to state, and then I want to let you take it from there.
Sure.
One thing that I don't understand about people, they keep talking about nuclear as being some sort of panacea for us as far as energy goes.
Yeah, it's
and
not.
I don't see it as a panacea because it has a destructive byproduct, which is the spent fuel rods that have to get buried somewhere.
Yeah, not to mention the radioactive vessel itself, plus all the incredible environmental damage that's done mining uranium, transporting it, refining it, all the energy that's consumed in those processes. No, it's absolutely not. Plus, it's not safe. You know, without the Price-Anderson Act, without you and I backstopping the nuclear industry, there'd be no nuclear industry because no insurance company in the world would go near them. So, you know, spot on, Deborah. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max,
yes,
what's up?
Good afternoon. Well, if things are as bad or worse than we think, who will tell us the horrible truth? Now, I'm an Obama supporter. And I know I hear from some of these more progressive than now folks that, oh, he's not really a progressive. I'm hearing them from people who told me there was no difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush eight years ago.
I've not heard any serious person say Obama's not really a progressive. But anyhow, your point.
And it is disturbing. I am hearing, you know, of the Chicago School of Economic boys, the ones he's hanging out with, are still basically Friedmanites. They're sort of Friedman light.
Yep.
And this bothers me. So Obama's still my man, but we got to keep his feet to the fire, and he's got to start channeling Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, that's the point. He keeps saying,
as bad as we think, we're going to have to get leveled with before we get the bad news some other source.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely right, Max. And the reality is, and this is what Barack Obama has been saying, is it's not about him, it's about us. He keeps saying, this campaign is about you, not about me. You being us, you and me, the voters. It's about us. And John McCain keeps saying, oh, it's about leadership, it's about him, John McCain. And Obama's saying, no, it's all about all of us. And it's so true. And we have to get active, and we have to get involved, and we have to be directing Barack Obama himself. 16 minutes past here.
This is Tom Hartman.
Minutes past the hour. Larry Scott on the line with us, the editor-in-chief at VAWatchdog.org, the nation's premier veterans site, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to.
And that's exactly what we're doing, Tom.
There you go. Well, you are, and you're doing a marvelous job, Larry. I see that thousands, I would say, my understanding was it was tens of thousands of veterans have been denied payments because the geniuses in the Bush administration decided that they should outsource the job of figuring out who should get what benefits.
Oh, that's a marvelous story. You know, for years, this is a program called Concurrent Receipt, and for a number of years, military retirees, these are folks who did 20 years or more, could collect their retirement, but if they were then considered disabled by the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, they, of course, would get a disability check. But for years, those two offset each other.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say if you had $500 coming in VA disability, that $500 was taken from your retirement pay. It made no sense, but it was what the law was. Well, a few years ago, Congress rectified that whole thing and said, wait a minute, concurrent receipt makes sense. Retirement has nothing to do with disability. They both should be paid. So they authorized retro pay, and you just don't want to know what happened. And basically, the Department of Defense, DOD, went out and subcontracted this whole thing to Lockheed Martin. This was the Defense Finance Accounting Service, contracted with Lockheed Martin, and said, you figure it out and you pay these guys. This has been going on a couple of years. They still haven't figured it out. Some veterans have been flat out denied money, tens of thousands of dollars they should have gotten. Others have received too small an amount. And in a report released by Dennis Kucinich, they've determined that over 1,000 veterans who should have been paid have died since this program started and never received their payments. They're holding a hearing today on Capitol Hill about this. Hopefully we'll get to the bottom of this situation.
And meanwhile, I guarantee you that the executives at Lockheed Martin are doing just fine, thank you very much.
They're doing just fine. You know, we'll get it sorted. As a matter of fact, they released a little bit of prepared testimony that they're going to give on Capitol Hill today. They said, no, things are in order, and we will get this all sorted out. Yes, there have been errors, but we'll take care of it. Yeah. Well, no, they're not going to take care of it because they've been working on it for a couple of years and haven't been able to take care of it. So Dennis Kucinich is trying to get to the bottom of this.
And good on Dennis. Mm-hmm. Larry, a question a lot of callers have asked me, and this has been brought up a number of times, and I'm just not quite sure what to do with it. John McCain is apparently pulling a disability check of $50,000-$60,000 bucks a year.
No, about $58,000.
$58,000, okay,
right.
Thank you. And because he is classified by the Navy as fully disabled.
That's correct.
And yet he has a job, and mm-hmm. he's looking for a better job.
Yep.
And, you know, how does that work? I mean, if you're fully disabled, don't you qualify for being fully disabled by being actually unable to work?
No, the difference between being unemployable and disabled are two entirely different things,
okay,
Tom. And
good.
When the Navy determined that John McCain was disabled, it was based on the severity of his disabilities at that time.
Right, he can't raise his arms above a certain
right.
point. I mean, he actually has physical disabilities.
He does have physical disabilities, and I would not want to have been put in the situation how he ended up
right.
with those physical disabilities being tortured in a POW.
Right, this is why I said I have not, up right. to this point, been willing to criticize him for this because, you know, he went through hell, and if he's being paid for that, you know, on the back end by the country that asked him to go through hell, I got no problem with it.
That's basically it, Tom, and that is they rate the disabilities and say, now remember, that $58,000 that he gets today was much, much smaller when he was rated many, many years ago and got out of the Navy. It has mm-hmm. grown because there are cost of living allowances and increases every year, so
right.
that started off as a fairly small sum of money. But what John McCain has done, like many other disabled veterans, has really risen above those disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
We don't ask people to give that money back when they rise above their disabilities. Let me give you a couple of examples. Max Cleland, who lost two legs and an arm in Vietnam,
right.
who went on, of course, to become a U.S. senator, and he was also head of the VA back when it was an administration, before
right.
it was a cabinet-level department. But no one ever said, hey, Max, geez, now that you've got a good job, what about all that disability money you're getting?
Right.
Another example of that is Tammy Duckworth, who lost the helicopter pilot, who lost both legs in Iraq, went on to run for Congress in Illinois. Of course, she was not successful there. But she is now head of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. And what Tammy has done, as so many disabled veterans have done, they have risen above their disabilities to become successful in life. And just because you have become successful and risen above those disabilities, that doesn't mean the disabilities have gone away. Therefore, those payments continue. Now, many veterans over the years are re-rated. If you are receiving payments from the VA, they can call you in and examine those disabilities and say, have they gotten better? Have they gotten worse? If they've gotten better, they can decrease your benefits. If they've gotten worse, they can increase your benefits. Basically, after a 20-year period, they figure there's not going to be much of a change, and they won't go back in and change that benefit rating. But that's basically the story on John McCain. He is
okay.
paid for the disabilities he received while on active duty. And, you know, it's really interesting, and I'd like to congratulate you for not bringing it up and not getting into it. And I noticed the Obama campaign, he hasn't either, because, you know, I think it's poison to even go there.
Yeah,
for anyone to even question that.
I do, too, and that's why I said, people at least about once a week, I'll get a caller who wants to discuss this, and my response to them always has been, you know, I really don't know that much about it. I want to talk to Larry Scott about it. So. Larry Scott is the chief cook and bottle washer, editor-in-chief over at VAWatchdog.org. Get over there, check it out, VAWatchdog.org. Thanks, Larry, for driving.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. And always an educational experience. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
To the limit. not heed the warnings. 'Cause I'll be my old self when I wake in the morning. Oh, but the night's still young, so I'm gonna have fun.
34 minutes past the hour. David Sirota on the line with us. His new book, The Uprising. This is an amazing piece of writing. And today, David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And davidsirota.com, of course, the website, and the Uprising Against Free Trade. This is, you know, I've been ranting about this for 6 years on this program and writing about it for two decades. This is from NAFTA and WTO and, you know, right across the board, really all the way back to Reagan starting the process of dismantling our tariff structure in the United States. This is nuts. What I don't understand, and maybe you can explain this to me, is how Tom Friedman can title a book The Olive Tree and the Lexus when the Lexus is the product of Toyota. Toyota in the 1950s was known as the Toyota, with a D, not a T, Toyota Loom Company. They made looms for weaving. They decided that they wanted to go into the car business. The Ministry of Trade, MITI, gave them grants and helped them out. The country protected them with tariffs so that nobody could compete against them. There was all this development money that went into it. I mean, basically, it was government intervention domestically. It was the Japanese government working together with Japanese industry that built the Lexus. And then Tom Friedman goes out and says, oh, this is why we need to throw away all the barriers to trade, is so that the Lexus will emerge. The Lexus emerged as a result of barriers to trade.
That's right. And look, Tom Friedman, now that we're talking about him, I mean, he's the guy who said that that he wrote columns supporting the Central American Free Trade Agreement, not having even read any of that agreement. All he said he needed to know was it was labeled free trade. So what you see here, Tom, is that, and you know this, is that those who argue for corporate written trade policies they're like fundamentalists. They're not talking about what's in these deals. They're not talking about facts. They're not talking about economic history. They're talking literally about a religion that they have complete and utter faith in. And let's be clear, the misnomer of quote unquote free trade, it bothers me so much, because these trade deals are not free. I mean, NAFTA is thousands of pages long. If you wanted a truly free trade deal, it would be one page, it would say no tariffs. The other thousands of pages are protections for corporate profits, protections that say patents, drugs should have patents in the developing world to keep drug prices high, copyright protections, intellectual property protections. What we have, these trade deals are free of only one thing. They're free of protections for human beings.
Right. Free of protections for labor.
Right, right. For humans, the environment, the human rights, the union rights. I mean, that's the only thing that they're free of. They include all sorts of protections for corporate profits. And I think the good news is that I think that people are starting to realize. I mean, if you look at polls, the public has shifted completely and dramatically against these deals. I think a lot of people can't tell you exactly what they don't like about these trade deals, but they know that these trade deals are not written for the ordinary person.
Well, they didn't like them in 92 either. When Clinton was running against George Bush, and they were both agreeing that the trade deals were great, and 19% of Americans came out and voted for Ross Perot, who had basically one issue. He was his opposition to NAFTA.
That's right. That's right. And you had less than
50% support for NAFTA at the time that Clinton pushed it, at the time that Bush pushed it through, and then Clinton signed it.
That's right. And I think that you know, there has been a long campaign to try to make it seem like a centrist or moderate or responsible position to be for these trade deals, when in fact what these trade deals are really resulting in is beyond even the wage cutting and environment destroying competition. It's really we're selling off our country because of this. I mean, we're watching the export of our economic assets because we have a trade policy that actually economically incentivizes that fire sale.
$2,040,833,000,000, the amount of money spent by foreign companies since Ronald Reagan became president to buy American companies.
It's really incredible. And what I would say is that the uprising that I describe in my book, I think The reason why it is a bipartisan uprising is because on rank and file people on both the right and left can see a direct line between the free trade fundamentalism of Ronald Reagan to Bush 1 to Clinton to Bush 2 to Tom Friedman and the pundits and the job outsourcing and wage cutting and environment destroying crisis. People can see that direct line. They can see it. And that's why you have this uprising.
You know, what astounds me is Jack Welch in his autobiography, the former chairman of or president of General Electric, which owns NBC and MSNBC, bragged about the fact that he was on a trip to India, and it occurred to him that there was all this English-speaking labor in India that was really cheap. And he had all these English-speaking people working for General Electric in the United States, answering phones and doing bookkeeping and things like that. And he thought, you know, why don't I outsource this stuff to India? And he essentially invented this and you know, lobbied to make sure that it would be protected and care, you know, all that kind of stuff. And takes credit basically for outsourcing millions of jobs, information services jobs and back office jobs and things to India. And nobody puts two and two together that that's GE, that's NBC. Gee, why would NBC be in favor of free trade?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And the issue here is that you have what you're talking about is you have an incentive. People have an incentive to push this fundamentalism. It's not just that people have sat down and objectively said, well, you know, free trade, the way we've constructed trade right now is good, is objectively good. No, most of the people pushing this trade policy have an agenda, and the agenda is about money.
Right. It's about their money. We're talking with David Sirota, davidsirota.com, his new book, The Uprising. And David, speaking specifically about the uprising against, in this context, and the book, the breadth of the book is much greater than this, but the uprising against these so-called free trade agreements, it seems to me that what we need is a pushback against... And in this regard, we're almost against globalization. And in this regard, we're almost becoming or using much of the language of the Barry Goldwater conservatives of the 60s who were freaked out about the United Nations. The UN has as its principal goal to promote world peace. And the major way that the UN constrains a nation is it says, you cannot, once you've signed the treaties to become a member of the UN, you cannot declare war on another country unless you can demonstrate that it's a defensive war. In other words, it's to stop wars. And that was enough of a restraint on American behavior that it freaked out Goldwater and all the conservatives. Now you've got the WTO saying, you know, we're going to rewrite your economic rules that are going to affect even a single person who wants to be an entrepreneur. This seems like a much more intrusive, you know, in our face, taking over our country, a surrender of sovereignty. It's almost like the progressive movement is now calling for the same kind of new nationalism, essentially, that the conservatives were calling for in their opposition to the, and continue to, in their opposition to the UN, except that the UN is about peace and the WTO is about a small handful of rich elites getting richer.
Oh, you're absolutely right, and it's a really interesting analogous situation in the similarities between progressives and conservatives on this. And I think this is why in Congress, for instance, you find that many progressives who are fighting this trade policy find some unlikely allies on the right, and some of those unlikely allies come to the trade debate on the right precisely because of these sovereignty issues. Look. These trade deals, what's in these trade deals are provisions that allow foreign companies to sue our state and local governments if our state and local governments pass laws, public interest laws, that those foreign companies can claim cut into their profits, right?
That's right.
Yeah. If your city passes a clean water law, you may have a Canadian or a Mexican company sue your city for damages because that Canadian or Mexican chemical company wants to be able to put that chemical in the
And in fact, that has happened. I mean, MTBE is the most famous example. Article 16, paragraph 5, page 10 of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade that created the World Trade Organization says, no reservation may be made in respect to any provision of this agreement. What that means is Congress cannot change the WTO agreements. They cannot be changed by any individual nation state. Only the WTO can modify itself. I mean,
and what's so telling about it is that public interest groups, unions, environmental groups, grassroots groups, community groups, don't have the similar right to demand the enforcement of labor laws, of environmental laws, right? The labor union in China can't go to the international court or the NAFTA tribunal or the WTO tribunal and say, we want labor laws enforced. They can't do that. But corporations can go to the international tribunal and say, we want our investor rights enforced. It's a complete, right. The hypocrisy is just telling.
Well, and corporations are treated as sovereign entities, as if they were nation states.
That's right. And again, nonprofit groups, unions, grassroots groups, anything that deals with that's a group about humans, any provisions that are about protecting humans, that's the only thing that these trade deals are free of.
Yeah. And the people being defended are folks like, billionaires like Tom Friedman and all his buddies, his corporate buddies. I mean, it boggles my mind. And it's a great thing that what you're doing, David Sirota, and writing The Uprising and writing about this, one of the best syndicated columnists in the United States right now, and helping people wake up to these some would say painful economic realities. But, we're being screwed. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Absolutely. So,
David Sirota, davidsirota.com, his website, his new book, The Uprising. If you don't have it, get it now. And, David, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our number. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
Welcome back, 9.5 minutes before the hour.
Yep,
the World Trade Organization has the same status as the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, and basically Congress. I mean, don't get me started, like they say. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Andrew in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great. But I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Good show, as always.
Thank you.
I wanted to make you aware, if you weren't already, about Comcast channel lineup change. That they've taken, how there's a block of news channels between 30 and 36 or so?
Well, it varies from city to city. In Portland, it's in the 50s, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Pretty much they keep them all together so you can just, bounce back and forth.
Right.
MSNBC has been moved up to an upper tier all by itself.
Yeah, they did that here in Portland about 4 or 5 months ago, was it, Sean? They kicked it up into the 100s. It's now channel 128, I think, and it used to be like 55 or whatever it was, and right next to CNN. And not only that, you got to pay an extra buck or a couple bucks a month to get it now, because it's now part of the premium services.
Right, and most of us are trying to cut corners. We just have basic or less.
Yeah. And so if you want basic cable, your choice is Fox or CNN.
Yeah, it just seems to me that, especially with Keith Olbermann being so vocal and such a champion of the progressive, our situation, it almost seems like electronic book burning.
I think that it's entirely possible, Andrew, and I've been watching this and scratching my head for a long time, and it wouldn't surprise me at all to learn that there's a political agenda behind this. Thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry to hear that it's hit your city just like it hit our city. I do a local show here in Portland as well, and now Carl Wolfson and I do it in the mornings, and Carl mostly does it, but we had a lot of discussion of this when it happened here in Portland, and there was a whole, conspiracy theory around it, and they were like, oh, no, this is just, they have to move to digital, and so it's got to be done, and we're just going to, but I'm increasingly not buying it. Albuquerque, New Mexico. Matthew. Hey, Matthew, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can. You're on the air.
Hey, I was just curious to know if you've ever read any books by William Strauss and Neil Howe.
Yeah, The Fourth Turning, Generations of America. The Fourth Turning was my favorite.
Yes, I really like that.
In fact, I've had them on the show.
You've had them on the show?
Yes, it's probably been a year.
I was going to ask if you could ever get them back on. I mean, unfortunately, Bill Strauss died last year. I didn't know that. He died of cancer.
Yeah.
But I just want to say that their theory on history and how it repeats in cycles is very interesting.
Oh, it's absolutely brilliant, and I've done a couple of shows on it. I've talked about it at some length, and we'll return to it. Thank you, Matthew, for reminding me of it. It's an excellent topic, and if you haven't read their books, I recommend starting with The Fourth Turning, because I think that we are right now living in The Fourth Turning, and you will get what that means when you read the book. And it's really Strauss and Howe are the authors. And the book is called The Fourth Turning, and it's been out for, you know, a decade or so, but it's brilliant, brilliant. Joe in Endicott, New York. Hey, Joe.
Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
As I told the young lady, I'm probably a little older than most of your listeners, but I'm going back a little bit. In 1948, I just got out of high school, and there was a slam dunk for Tom Dewey.
Yeah.
He was going to be president. And then I had a copy of the Daily News, New York Daily News, from the next day that says Dewey wins, and
right.
We all know that he didn't.
Right.
In 1952, I spent about 50-some hours on duty in Korea, keeping a radar set going, because Eisenhower said, if I win, I'm coming over. See you guys.
Right.
So he did, and in 19...
And for our listeners, I mean, it's important to remember that Eisenhower ran as the anti-war candidate. He ran essentially as the Obama candidate in the election of 52.
Yeah, but they're totally different credentials. But anyway, 52, I didn't vote for him. We didn't have absentee. 56, I voted for him. That's the last time I voted for a Republican. Now we fast forward to 2008. My big concern right now is, and every time I listen to something, I hear Obama seems to be on the defensive.
Yeah.
I don't think he's taken a real offensive attitude and stand on many, many issues.
Yeah, I wouldn't be so worried about it right now, Joe, but I would say that it's not enough for us to vote. And thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to WNYY. We have to get out there and get active. And per Joe's comment, let me just play for you a television ad, the audio from a television ad from the Eisenhower campaign in 52. This is how Dwight Eisenhower ran for president.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Did you get that? He's met the world's leaders. In other words, he talks to our enemies. He's met the Soviet Union. He knows how to work with them.
He knows how to win wars.
I mean, he was the absolute antithesis of John McCain. It makes me crazy to see in the media these analogies that the Republican and right-wing strategists and talkmeisters keep trying to draw between John McCain and Dwight Eisenhower, because they were both military men. Dwight Eisenhower was a man of peace. He had seen hell in World War II, and he never wanted to see it again. And he ran on the platform of ending the war in Korea, and he did it when he became president. He ended the war in Korea. And there you have it. I mean, you know, vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace.
November 4th, vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower.
Yeah, there you go. Coming up tomorrow, Dr. John Lott, conservative columnist. We're going to be discussing why he's defending the profits of big oil. Plus, New Yorker magazine columnist Jane Mayer stops by about her new book, The Dark Side. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you, democracy begins with you, the Obama campaign begins with you. Get out there, get active, show up, volunteer, participate, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.